Good evening. Good evening. And welcome to the second of the 2007 Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. My name is Dan Traister. I work in Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Let me begin by asking those of you, even those of you who signed the guest book on Tuesday, if you wouldn't mind signing it again this evening. Those of you who haven't, please do, and there are announcements of forthcoming events to be picked up right around the corner where the guest book is sitting. I also want to remind you that there'll be a question and answer session following this afternoon's talk, and at the reception after that, people can continue speaking with one another and with David Hall. I'm here tonight in place of Carton Rogers, Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, who greeted you on Tuesday but has been detained today. My tasks are, first, to express his regrets that he must be late, and second, to serve in his place by introducing Roger Chartier, himself here to introduce our speaker. And the whole concept of introducing Roger Chartier gives one pause. Some tasks seem profoundly unnecessary. I wanted to see, however, what others have done in this situation, so I looked up Roger on Google. I'm happy to report that at rogerchartier.com, I learned that Roger Chartier is a disc jockey for weddings, anniversaries, parties, and various functions in New Bedford, Mass. And he is also a crooner who has brought us such CDs as Sailor Songs and Sailing Away. Their absence from Penn's collections of sound recordings is one I can only bemoan. Learning about Roger's other life as a quondam whaling village entertainer proved much more exciting, to me anyway, than finding and then repeating to you the more easily observed facts, such as those found on the website of Penn's History Department, which tells us that Roger teaches at Penn. He's had a distinguished career at the École des Hautes Études in Paris. Elsewhere, we discover that Roger has recently been appointed to the chair, I believe, in Writings and Cultures in Modern Europe at the Collège de France. We could mention the more than 40 monographic or edited works in which he's had a hand, and attempt to count his articles. But the most important things about him are not the grandeur of his appointments or the number of his books and articles. It is rather that his influence, scholarly and personal, on those fortunate colleagues, students, faculties, and visitors whose paths he's crossed or who've just read him, has been almost literally incalculable. A person of striking capaciousness of vision, grasp of detail, and generosity of spirit, he's someone whom a person I was speaking with just yesterday, and I have to say that this is before either of us knew that Carton would be late and I'd have to be standing here in his place today, called simply a mensch. Now, I know that's not a scholarly introduction, but in fact it works for me. It's my pleasure to introduce Roger Chartier, not yet sailing away.
Thank you. And it is my pleasure to introduce the second of the Rosenbach lectures given by David Hall. It is for me a superb occasion for recognizing how much David's role and work were important for building a bridge between two fields of scholarship which were for too long totally separated. On the one hand, the history of Protestant vernacular culture in colonial America, and on the other hand, the history of the relations between popular and elite culture in early modern Europe. I met David for the first time during a conference at the American Antiquarian Society in 1980, which was the first and decisive step for the collective history of the book in America, of which he became the general editor. We met again 2 years later at a conference on popular culture organized by Stephen Kaplan at Cornell. In the introduction to his superb collection of essays entitled Cultures with a S of print, published in 1996, David acknowledges the impact of this conference on his own way of thinking about the politics of culture in America between the 17th and the 19th century. Referring to the works of the historian of cultural practices in early modern Europe, he wrote, the conference at Cornell, was an important step in linking my nascent project with theirs. Such links were rooted first in historical realities, since American cultural practices and representations had their origins in early modern Europe. But they were based also on a shared historiographical perspective that understands the making and remaking of culture as, I quote David, ongoing exchanges and negotiations. Ongoing exchanges and negotiations which explains the creation and strength in America of a middle ground culture located between high and low, the metropolitan and the local, Puritan beliefs and secular wonders circulated by cheap print. It's such an approach. Book history and history of reading became essential for David. Consequently, the dialogue between him and historians working on the same topics on the other side of the Atlantic, that is to say, the social history of literacy, the book trade, authorship, appropriations of the written word, was still reinforced. We, the people of Europeanists, learned a lot from him. He led us to think about the specificities and also the multiple diversities of the American cultural exchanges and trajectories. David Hall's work was pioneered, a new transatlantic history so lively today. He obliged the Europeanist to sail westward. It's an expression I shared with the other Roger Chartier. And to recognize that if American readers were kept reading for a long time books printed in Europe, at least if England is Europe, at the same time, colonial and then Republican America proposed a cultural pattern profoundly original. David underlines this difference at the end of an essay devoted to the role of literacy and the book in revolutionary France and revolutionary America. I quote him, in the former revolutionary France, printing, reading, and reading were closely bound with a centralized aristocracy in the year before the revolution. In the later America, printing, writing, and reading were far more open-ended and inclusive. And he concluded, it took 1789 to break open the French system, but in America, 1776 may be understood as the outcome of existing structures. I am very glad that this series of lectures allows me to pay tribute to David's breakthrough work and to thank him on behalf of all his Europeanist readers and friends. Today, he will speak about a topic that once again is one of the more vividly debated amongst historians of European literature and culture, particularly for English drama or for French novels, that is to say, collective authorship. David Hall's second Rosenbach lecture is entitled Social Authorship, Collaboration and the Making of Printed Books. Please join me for welcoming him.
I said on Tuesday that I would reserve my a more fulsome or a larger expression of thanks for the concluding lecture on Monday, and that includes a response to that characteristically generous and insightful introduction by Roger. I want to say just a brief word about the handouts, two of which are here for illustration of things I cannot cover this afternoon, and two of which are pertinent to what I will be saying. The second of the handouts, for which I wrote a caption that reads, "A distressed Boston author corrects the London printing of his book." This is the often overlooked, and indeed I had overlooked it all my life until my late friend Hugh Amory called it to my attention. Cotton Mather's great folio History of New England was printed in London, and when copies arrived, he was startled, to say the least. The man he had hoped, the man to whom he had entrusted the task of correcting it against the manuscript, had failed to do so. The printer did a truly lousy job, and so Cotton hastily pulled together these errata. It's a two-page folio. Broadside, really, that is was then inserted in some copies of the American print. The London bookseller, Thomas Parker, sent over boxes of these things, and Mather hastily inserted some of these into some of the unsold copies. There were a lot of unsold copies, actually. I should say that this is a book, if you take the book with the inserted sheet, broadsheet, this was a perfect illustration of Hugh Amory's question, what constitutes an American book? Was the Magnalia an American book with the inserted sheets or not? The second, which is the fourth, brings us back to the Magnalia in a very different form. Cotton Mather had a cousin, Samuel, who happened to live in England. And whether at Cotton's initiative or Samuel's or some bookseller's vain hope of actually selling copies of the Magnalia, Samuel decided to create an abridgment of this very, very long book. And unfortunately, the reproduction does not show us the words "omit" at the top of the page, but a great many pages are simply drawn through, as this one is, and then to the side, you can just barely see that there was something at the side. Samuel Mather has written a few words in which he summarizes great chunks of the book get summarized in a few words. So we could all hope that we don't have cousins who try to take our work and do this to them. But as I say, nothing came of the project. The other two I will say a word about before we're done here this afternoon. My theme is those of you know who are here on Tuesday is making texts, although on Monday we shift to a variation on that theme, politics and texts. Yesterday, 2 days ago, I was dealing with handwritten texts. Today, I deal with printed, although in point of fact, as I again remarked on Tuesday, the line between the two is not so precise. Indeed, today, again, we'll see some blurring. And I should say that, should apologize to you, that just as on Tuesday, I said nothing about the actual processes of copying and so forth and so on. So today, booksellers and printers are essentially absent from this talk, mostly because there's just too much else to talk about in just about what I do want to cover. And rather than deluging you with details, I'm still going to deluge you with details, but I have to leave the printers and booksellers out, but they'll be in the longer version. And let me also say that, as I said on Tuesday, most of what I'm going to do today is a case study of John Cotton, although that comes at the second part of the talk. But I begin with John Cotton. John Cotton was shocked. When someone in the late summer of 1642 showed him a newly arrived copy of a London printed book that had his name on the title page, he learned for the first time that John Humphrey, a former member of his Boston congregation, had arranged for sermons Cotton had preached in Boston on the Book of Revelation to be published, that is, printed, and published in the form of sermon notes taken as the sermons were preached, as Humphrey himself acknowledged. Cotton learned, too, that although he would earn nothing from the book, Humphrey was being well rewarded. An entry in Winthrop's journal captures Cotton's reaction. "Now came over a book of Mr. Cotton's sermons upon the seven vials. J. Humphrey had gotten the notes from some who had took them by characters and printed them in London. He had 300 copies for it." That probably is by a factor of five or so too large. "He had 300 copies for it, which was a great wrong to Mr. Cotton, and he was much grieved at it, for it had been fit he should have perused and corrected the copy before it had been printed." The story tells us that, wanting control over what he wrote or preached, Cotton had been denied that control by three intermediaries, the anonymous note taker or takers, John Humphrey, who transmitted these notes to London, and the bookseller, who accepted those notes as a sufficient copy text for a printed book. But I like to think that Cotton was a good deal less surprised than Winthrop has him being, for he surely knew that London printers and booksellers routinely accepted sermon notes as copy texts for sermons series they were printing. Indeed, during the 1630s, just to give some local examples, during the 1630s, most of Thomas Hooker's sermon series, another immigrant minister, most of Thomas Hooker's sermon series had been published in this manner, as was the first printing of the greatest steady seller among colonial writers' books, Thomas Shepard's The Sincere Convert, printed in 1641. Shepard had nothing to do with preparing the manuscript of the book and described it in a letter to an English friend as a ragged child, and traced its origins to a collection of notes in a dark town in England, which one procuring of me published without my will or privity. I scarce know what it contains, nor do I like to see it. Considering the many typographical errors, some absurd, and the confession of him that published it, that it comes out mutilated and altered from what was first written. I might add that I cost my eyes considerable strain because the second printing says corrected by the author, 1646. So I sat in Houghton Library comparing page after page after page, hoping to find those corrections. And finding only a very slightly superior job of copy editing. A bookseller's whatever. For the colonial writer, as for those who practiced their craft in England, the story was the same, of texts passing into the hands of intermediaries who in several different ways made their presence felt. Some because they decided how the text should be printed and bound, the booksellers and printers. Others because they chose the copy text or intervened as it was being printed or made other kinds of interventions in a text. Still others because they supplied prefaces or a title page or dedications or other aspects of the pretext, or what we now call the paratext, and others, too, who sought out patrons or subscribers to pay for the costs of publication. So this afternoon, I want to, turning to printed books, describe the passage of books through the hands of these intermediaries, some of whom are collaborators in a more specific sense. I use the word collaboration here a little loosely, as some of you will be able to point out when the question period comes. So collaboration, for me, just for right now, has two different meanings. It has the meaning that is familiar for students of Shakespeare, who collaborates on a play. And such forms of collaboration also existed in New England. For example, the well-known translation of the Book of Psalms from the Hebrew into English, the so-called Bay Psalm Book of 1649, was an act of collaboration. Five or six different ministers shared the work of translating and I'm sure corrected each other's translations. That's an example of collaboration in one sense. But there are other forms of collaboration. For example, the poetry of Anne Bradstreet, to which I'll make an allusion a little while later, which was carried to London without her knowledge and printed in London, involves the collaboration of those who wrote commendatory verse, those who wrote the prefaces, those who carried the manuscript to London, those who arranged the printing, and so on and so forth. Either way, either form, these acts of collaboration carry us beyond the figure of the solitary author and the author-controlled text to a much wider field of practices and meanings that, for the colonial writer, as for his English counterpart, is evoked by the phrase social authorship that I borrow from the literary historian Margaret Izell. My point of entry into this field of practices and meanings would start, not today, but would start at the point at which a writer's original was transformed into fair copy. And then my way of narrating the story would be to turn successively to each element of the pretext or paratext, but today I limit myself to two of those aspects of the pretext or paratext, the practice of anonymity and the insertion of a preface and what a preface is about. I should say that I'm particularly interested in what prefaces tell us about provenance. A great many prefaces in the 17th century, if they are written especially by the intermediaries or the collaborators, contain stories of provenance that I will draw upon when I turn to the figure of John Cotton. Let me then turn to anonymity. And at this point, you might want to just look at the very first of these handouts here. Naming the writer was the least certain feature of a 17th century title page. And not because texts were necessarily controversial. As Marthy North has pointed out in her terrific study of anonymity, within the English book trades, more than 800 known authors were published anonymously between 1475 and 1640, a figure that, as she remarks, would be much greater if pseudonyms and other forms of naming other than the author's name were included. Nor was 1640 a moment of transition, for anonymity persisted well into the 18th century and would take on a fresh significance in the 19th. A practice used this widely was, as North has ably argued, and I will draw on her for some more here, as North has ably argued, caught up in paradoxes that mean we must understand this practice as, to quote her, a flexible convention that for some writers was an act of self-protection, for others an act of modesty, and for some texts an accident of text transmission. On the New England side, and this also has relevance to the English, anonymity can be associated with certain formats or genre. For example, broadside verse was invariably anonymous or only with the initials of the versifier, and verse in almanacs was, to quote a line from the almanac, New England Almanac of 1670, of incerti autoris, also rarely, if ever, identified. Printed libels, like their manuscript counterparts, never indicated who wrote them, for good reason. And the almanacs written by Harvard College tutors were customarily anonymous, or at best signed with initials, or with the pseudonym simply Philomath. As Marcy North points out, anonymity is paradoxical in that it can actually be a means of emphasizing the presence of the author, or conversely, the presence of other agents or actors who have the power to decide whether the author's name is on the title page or not. And as she also remarks, anonymity can be a way of separating a writer's value from the marketplace, or again, conversely, of underscoring that connection. Does a writer's name have, as it were, cash value or not have cash value? Of course, we associate ourselves anonymity with secrecy at a time when various restrictions were, there was no such thing as sort of free expression, either in England or New England. New England writers were well aware of the political significance of anonymity, given the history of Protestant radicals in England and their underground Catholic counterparts, almost all of whom published without their names being on the title pages. The most celebrated example are the Marprelate tracts of the 1580s. But just the other day, I was reading a study of Milton and pointed out that his first three tracts against episcopacy were published anonymously, 1639, 40, 41. So it's a very, very common practice at a certain moment of political controversy or certain political situations, of course, to revert to anonymity. Yet on home ground, namely New England, there was little reason for any colonial writer to worry about the consequences of publishing under his own name, and not until the mid-1680s, when civil authority passed into the hands of an anti-Puritan royal governor, did anyone do so for political reasons, the one exception to this being tracts to which I'll allude on Monday, dealing with a controversy of church order in the early 1660s. Where anonymity was conventional, not political, was, of course, in situations of collective authorship and in situations where the truth-speaking writer removed himself from the marketplace of print in keeping with the Protestant vernacular tradition. So that, to choose one example, the separatist Puritan Robert Cushman, who visited Plymouth in 1621, may have preached a sermon there, but said he preached a sermon there that was published in London in 1622, writes of himself, of a sermon that does not have his name on the title page, that he had not set down my name, partly because I seek no name, not seeking literary fame, that would be contrary to the posture that he's taking, and principally because I would have nothing esteemed by names. But to give another example from early Plymouth, and there are too many examples, collective authorship, literally collective authorship, explains why the two or three colonists who participated in writing the compilation of texts published in 1622, a relation or journal of the beginning and proceedings of the English plantation settled at Plymouth, did not identify themselves, except in one instance under the initials EW, which we know stands for Edward Winslow, and the two English writers who provided the prefatory material also use initials unknown, and then the still mysterious G. Mort, which has never been deciphered. No one can figure out who the G. Mort was. Likewise, the collaborators who fashioned the Besson book left their names off the title page, although there is a wonderfully humorous poem by Thomas Shepard identifying them. And New England's First Fruits, published in 1642, a celebration of the first Harvard commencement and also a brief account of missionary outreach, is anonymous, again, because it was collectively written. And so on and so forth. What makes anonymity so provisional as a practice is that in book after book, other evidence enabled readers to identify the author. In English literary history, so I learned from Marcy North, Spencer's playfulness with his name in the Shepherd's Calendar is a famous example. Anne Bradstreet's name is not on the title page of The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up, a collection of her poems printed in London in 1650. But the title page did identify her as a woman, and not far into the cluster of commendatory verse, she was identified first as A.B. and three more times as Anne Bradstreet, in one instance as wife of the worshipful Simon Bradstreet, Esquire. And once we get past the commendatory poems, The book opens with a poem of hers dedicating the verse to her most honored father, Thomas Dudley Esquire, signed Anne Bradstreet. Provisional indeed. The first edition of Mary Rowlandson's captivity narrative, The Sovereignty and Goodness of God, published in Cambridge in 1682, was anonymous in the formal sense of not having her name on the title page. But the Indian raid on Lancaster, Massachusetts, that had occasioned her captivity and which she narrates in this story, had been widely publicized by word of mouth, and another burst of publicity had accompanied the campaign to raise the ransom money and help her impoverished family. In the opening pages, she mentions her husband's absence in Boston and a sermon that her husband, Joseph Rowlandson, preached in 1678 after the family had been relocated to Wethersfield, was included in most printings of the captivity narrative with his name on the title page. So Joseph and Mary. She would also thank by name some of the family's benefactors and anyone who had access to the London 1682 printing found her name on the title page. The one contributor to the book, who to this day remains unidentified, was the Per Amicum, who signed the preface. The men who collaborated with Rowlandson and Bradstreet in bringing their manuscripts into print may not have wanted to put a woman's name on the title page in keeping with the convention that women were always and everywhere encompassed within the rule of modesty, that is, not speaking in public. But as the title pages of Cotton Mather's immense corpus indicate, gender was a secondary factor in decisions about anonymity. Year in and year out, Mather omitted his name from 2/3 of his almost 400 publications, usually as a sign, not very persuasive, of his humility. But as with Bradstreet and Rowlandson, he and his collaborators filled his books with allusions to him as author. Thus, in the early stages of his career, Boston booksellers were advertising as early as 1692 lists of his imprints, some of them previously anonymous, under the heading Books by Mr. Mather. His name was not on the title page of the spiritual biography he wrote of his brother Nathaniel, published in London in 1689, one of his first London successes as a book, but he signed the preface. And his full name appeared on this separate title page that preceded the three sermons printed with this spiritual biography. Robert Califf, the Boston merchant who hated Mather, Robert Califf played the part of a bibliographer in 1700 by attributing correctly the anonymous Pietas in Patrium, Mather's, Life of William Phipps. In other words, Califf exposed Mather as the author. But Mather himself abandoned any pretense to anonymity by including the book in the Magnalia Christi Americana 2 years later. Anonymity, therefore, is provisional. It sits within a wider field of practices, perhaps less a means of effacing the author, at least in New England practice, than in directing the reader to the text and in the context of the vernacular tradition, emphasizing the writer's humility. I turn now to prefaces, and there is a great deal to learn from prefaces, and I have to just limit myself here to one, and that is the work that prefaces do to align, to bring together a contradiction that exists for sermons in particular, the contradiction between divine truth, divine speech conveyed by the Word and the Holy Spirit, and the all too human instrumentality of the speaker's voice or pen. To bring these two together, that is one of the tasks of prefaces for New England texts printed in England or New England. So that again and again and again, we find in these prefaces a peculiar assertion or it might seem peculiar to us because we are not inclined to make it, namely the assertion that I didn't want to publish this text, but someone else made me publish this text. This is a trope, a rhetorical trope, that I have learned from Kevin Dunn's book on these matters. It goes back to antiquity, the classical writers, and I was reminded of Mark Twain's joke, or comment about jokes in the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. The Connecticut Yankee keeps complaining that he's hearing jokes in the year 1000 that he's going to hear again in the year 1885. we're dealing here with a very, very old figure of speech, as it were, or self-representation by writers. Old or new, it had an extraordinary currency among the colonists. Thomas Shepard's version of the trope was to insist that he had never intended to publish his sermons on the Sabbath, and that they were printed in London happened only because, quote, some have so far compelled me to publish what my own heart hath opposed. In 1652, the very first printed book of sermons in New England, Richard Mather insists that he had no thoughts of his sermons on justification ever being published, and that he had agreed to publication only after, quote, sundry godly Christians and brethren, having heard them delivered in preaching, came to me with a serious and solemn request that I would further and fulfill their earnest desires in this thing. We might say, enough, enough. But he keeps going on. Against which motion, though I alleged many objections, yet they still continued to desire as formerly, whereupon at the last, considering with myself that God, who hath the hearts of all good men in his hands, might in moving their hearts have some further intent therein for his own glory and the good of some other of his servants, that then I at first did apprehend or could perceive, he allowed the printing to pursue. 30 years later, Samuel Willard was equally self-effacing, describing himself in the preface to Mercy Magnified of 1684 as deeply sensible of my own insufficiency to display these mysteries, and that all the account which I can give of the publishing this imperfect thing is knowing it the desire and duty of those that fear God. For me personally, the most delicious of these is one of Increase Mather's from the early 70s. Increase Mather had been ill, and he plays the dying speaker trope, a variant of this humility trope. I am dying. You won't be bothered with my publications anymore. Here's the last one. But whatever. It served him once. And then once more toward the end of his life. He lived for another 50 years. So. Were we to take all these protestations at face value, we would wonder how it was that Willard, Shepherd, the Mathers published so much. But again, I think the answer lies in understanding the trope of humility as part of a wider field of signs and practices, all of them, including dedications, and title pages, and anonymity, and much else besides, means of establishing the power of writing, and in some sometimes paradoxical ways, the presence of the author. We might say that authority flowed from a curious compounding of presence and absence. The godly writer who is formidably present because of his piety and because he claims to speak only as Christ's representative was also the writer whose name was often absent from a title page, who insisted that nothing of his had any merit, who feared being exposed in print, and who often had in fact entrusted his manuscript to someone else carry into print. I turn now to John Cotton. John Cotton was many things, but for my purposes, what we need to know about him is that he was the most controversial of all the ministers who participated in the founding of New England and remained controversial. Questioned in the 1620s about his orthodoxy in England, accused of complicity in the Antinomian uprising of 1636-37, taunted by Roger Williams for his critique of liberty of conscience, denounced by Presbyterians for being so fervent and early on so radical a promoter of the congregational way. Cotton was a controversial figure. He was controversial already in 1630 when he was asked by the Massachusetts Bay Company to help it fend off rumors that the company was secretly promoting separatism. And this takes us back to a text I referred to on Tuesday, namely the letter he wrote to the Salem minister, already in Salem, Minister Samuel Skelton. In this instance, Cotton wanted to exploit the singular possibilities, the particular possibilities the scribal publication allowed him to be private, but to be public at the same time, for this letter was widely copied, and he wanted it copied. He continued to publish scribally during the 1630s after he came to New England, for example, writing letters, long letters, back to England, expounding some of the principles of the Congregational Way. And for those of you who don't know, so the Congregational Way was extraordinarily radical in the context of the Church of England and even of Protestant ecclesiology, because it limited church membership to visible saints, and it turned a great deal of power in church government, in the running of the church, running of local congregations, over to the lay people, and there's no supervisory authority. Each congregation is its own autonomous unit. This was seen as astonishingly dangerous to do on the part of those who were moderate or conservative, even among the Puritan group, even among Puritans in England. He was also a radical because he wanted to, when he arrived in New England, he became infatuated with the vision of what we would call godly rule. How could you actually make scripture the rule, the basis of secular civil institutions, an idea actually that John Winthrop never shared. And so he's also a promulgator of godly rule. He's radical in every respect, also theologically, he's a radical. One of his texts, the earliest of his texts to survive that we know of on godly rule, was a text called Moses, His Judicials. And I'll say a little bit more about it in a moment. But it circulated in scribal copies, and one copy was printed in London in 1641, an example of his radicalism. And meanwhile, these other letters he was sending were also examples of his radicalism. And then, of course, it got out. It got out, as I was saying on Tuesday, it got out that he had befriended Anne Hutchinson and indeed had sympathized with Anne Hutchinson and supported her. To run with the wolves, as it were, to run with the radicals, as it were, was to draw attention to every word he said or wrote and to increase the risk that others would want to publish his manuscripts. So indeed it happened with text after text, starting with Moses' Judicials, 1641. I'll come back to that. 1642, the text that John Humphrey oversaw, the pouring out of the seven vials. And then there's another text that remains to this day, in one sense it remains in manuscript, although it was printed by a modern scholar, and that is another swatch of his preaching on the book of Revelation, a dangerous book on which to preach. The provenance of the manuscript of these sermons is a manuscript owned by Thomas Shepard. And we have to imagine Thomas Shepard sitting in Cambridge, his ears wide open, his eyes focused on First Church Boston, waiting, listening, and writing in his journal this marvelous sentence, 1639, same year of the sermon being preached, Mr. Cotton repents not, but is hid only, waiting to expose him, and collecting this manuscript sermon to hold and use as evidence against John Cotton. This is the Cotton who runs with the wolves, and others are circling around to trick him, to capture him, to expose him. But the public voice, the public voice that we hear in these early imprints, Godly Rule or the Sermons on Revelation of 1642, which by the way are a remarkable critique of power, state power, the public voice these publications ascribed to Cotton was not the same voice his readers would encounter in the books he began to write in the early 1640s. He began to change his points of view, and change his point of view toward unauthorized publication, which is all that had happened so far in terms of printed texts. Using intermediaries in London, he intervened to explain which of his publications on church government were authoritative and which were not, a process we may liken to self-censorship. It really was a process of self-censorship. This phase of his writing, this phase of his printed work, involves three books printed out of sequence. They have confusing titles, but I'll try to simplify for you. The first to be written, the first to make its way to England, arrived in England as a manuscript that circulated in handwritten copies for at least a year and possibly two before it was printed in London in 1645 as, simple title, The Way of the Churches. However, in 1644, 1 year before, the same bookseller had brought out The Keys of the Kingdom, and the same bookseller in 1648 offered a book which by its very title suggests what is happening, The Way of the Churches Cleared, Cotton's own commentary on his previous work. Why The Way was belatedly printed, The Way without the Cleared, The Way of 1645 was belatedly printed, and why the copy text was less than ideal was explained in a preface by the two anonymous English ministers who prepared it for printing. If all things in this treatise, they wrote in their introduction, as now printed, do not answer punctually word for word to the first written copy, what they have done is to find one of the manuscript copies circulating in England, and they don't know which one has authority. If this does not answer punctually word for word to the first, meaning Cotton's written copy, let the reverend author and the candid reader pardon us, because we had not the fairest copy, nor knew we till the book was near done that there was a better to be had. Sounds a little like some Shakespearean printer, right? Nor to this day yet ever saw it. That is, there's a rumor that somewhere around the corner there's a better copy of this thing. Therefore, we were forced to shift with this. And then the two editors, who were congregationalists, but in the fluid field of congregationalism in the early 1640s, they said that you should know, to their readers, that this text differs from the Keys of 1644, although it predated the Keys. And they inserted asterisks as places where they disagreed with Cotton's interpretation of congregationalism. Collaboration, indeed. We don't know anything about the provenance of the Keys of 1644, but we know a great deal about the provenance of The Way Cleared, again, thanks to double prefaces. The two English congregationalists who wrote the preface, the opening to the reader, had known Cotton in England, and they, too, had problems with his congregationalism, even in this more conservative version of his thinking, so that they used their preface to articulate a different set of stances on topics like various topics of church order. Here, the censoring voice is theirs, not Cotton's, although, of course, they're dealing with a book that is a rewriting of his earlier work. And then finally we come to the last of the prefaces I wish to talk about, the second preface to The Way Cleared. And here we have the kind of doublespeak that complicates any narrative, any uncomplicated narrative of provenance. Because the man who wrote this preface said to his readers, let us be warned by that good account this book renders unto us of facile credulity, either in reports or letters or books, unless they be handed to us from the authors themselves. But they can't actually prove that they've been handed this manuscript by John Cotton. They raise the bar, and they acknowledge the issues of raising the bar, even though they can't quite satisfy our expectations as to where the text came from. Just to go back to the Keys for a moment, Cotton Mather, who knew his grandfather's writings and knew the manuscript tradition better than anyone else in the 17th century, reports in his biography of Cotton that's in the Magnalia that, in point of fact, the printed edition of the Keys was incomplete, that he had seen a written copy in my hands, which contained some things that were never printed. In other words, the version that actually got into print was not the complete version of the Keys. But it's when we turn to Cotton's sermons and texts on godly rule, to go back now to the first of these, that we encounter the most complex history of printing and the most complex histories of copy texts. When the Moses His Judicials was published in London in 1641, anonymously, without Cotton's name on the title page, the bookseller provided a title that most definitely was not Cotton's, would not have appeared on the manuscript, an abstract of the laws of New England, as these are now established. And for decades and decades, this title misled historians, especially in the 19th century, to think that this actually was the first code of laws in New England. They were never enacted. It was just Cotton's ideal vision of what laws should be. So the 1641 text has no author, a title that is not Cotton's title. The book was then reprinted in London in 1655 with a preface by the former antinomian, now fifth monarchist, William Aspinwall, talking about running with the wolves, who did put Cotton's name on the title page and in his preface celebrated the possibilities for godly rule, adding material that may or may not have been in Cotton's manuscript. We have no way of knowing. The manuscript does not survive. But I'll just point out here that to expand this trail, Thomas Hutchinson, in the 18th century, another great collector of documents, owned a copy of the printed edition of 1641 with handwritten interpolations by John Winthrop against what Winthrop thought was the original manuscript. There are three different versions of this text, not uncharacteristic for a text that has a kind of radical cachet of the kind that this particular book had. And then we come to the printed sermons, of which there are a great many. As so commonly happened, the people in his English parish of St. Botolph's, where he was rector for quite a number of years, the people in his English parish took notes on his sermons that some 10 or 20 years after the fact, London booksellers willingly accepted as copy text. Yet the same booksellers inserted or commissioned prefaces that point out the problem of using these notes that Cotton himself had never reviewed. So, for example, in 1641, a London bookseller issues The Way of Life, I'll spare you the long title, introduced by someone who I now cannot identify in any way, who spoke candidly about the provenance and quality of the text. I could have wished, his name is William Morton, I could have wished, if it might have been, that it had passed under his own censure. And then it needed not fear the censure of any other. But seeing it was designed for the press, that desire I had of the public good, and that respect I have ever owned the author, inclined me to lend it the best furtherance I could, that others might receive benefit. You play the godly card, you're going to benefit from this no matter how corrupt the text may be. The same year, another London bookseller issued a series of sermons entitled God's Mercy, and whoever wrote the preface to the Christian reader acknowledged that the sermon series was based on broken notes taken from his mouth by the diligent hand of some well-disposed hearers and followers in England. And you can hear all these adjectives that are trying to reassure the reader, the well-disposed note taker. For a third series, a book published in 1658, A Practical Commentary Upon the First of John, the comments by an unknown figure who signed to the reader are astonishingly unspecific, saying only that these following notes had fallen by providence into his hands. And then he makes a gesture that we should always distrust. He had invited a group of ministers to read the text, or that's what he tells us he had done, invited a group of ministers to read the text and assure him that these were truly by John Cotton. They would have had no way of knowing whatsoever, but that's what they do. They attest to. Again, we're in a field of here, and good old Cotton Mather, we can throw lots of stones at him, but he sure knew texts, and so he describes the sermon series as having been preached in his youth and not published by himself. There are some things therein which he would not have inserted. I could go on and on with these stories. The most charming of them is a manuscript that the bookseller tells us was found behind a wall covered with dust. That's the only provenance story we have. And the book actually contains sermons by someone other than by Cotton, although it also has a sermon by Cotton in it. It's a compilation, a bookseller's compilation. So here then is John Cotton. Too many manuscripts, too many intermediaries, too many nervy booksellers, printing whatever came up their way. This could sum up the story of Cotton's books, especially his sermon series, as these were published in his lifetime. He died in 1652, and for the rest of the 1650s. Manuscripts that date from the 1620s, like the sermons on John, published some 20 years later. Manuscripts from the 1630s, published much closer to the time of writing, but also printed, as in the case of his sermon that he preached in Salem in 1636 that I mentioned on Tuesday, not printed until 1713. Fascinating that this manuscript survived, and why someone brought it out in 1713, that's a question. And manuscripts of the 1640s and early 1650s, that as much for political reasons as for any other, floated around until a bookseller or some other intermediary arranged for them to be printed. I began by quoting Cotton's reaction when he saw the first printing of the Treatise on the Vials and how shocked he was. We must think of Cotton being shocked or disappointed again and again, not only with Humphrey's theft of the pouring out of the seven vials, but many other texts. And here you have the third page here shows him actually correcting. This is the only example I know of a New England writer correcting a printed text of something he had written. He comes back from the London bookseller, and Cotton is comparing it to his own copy that he has preserved of what he has written. It's hard to read here. By the way, I edited this 40 years ago without knowing what I was doing when I edited it. Bob St. George suggested I should arrange for another edition of that book and tell the full story here, but anyway, that's the way it goes. This is a text of the Antinomian controversy. That is to say, when the printed version reached him, he never wanted it to be printed. When the printed version reached him, he then actually can intervene and try and correct the text. But nothing then happens until I came along and printed the version that he wanted. So here then is Cotton, frustrated, angry, saddened, confused about the histories of text making for his own texts. And for me, the weight of all these disappointments shows in a step he took in 1651. A friend of his named Thomas Allen, minister in Charlestown, just across the river, was leaving for England. And if we can trust Thomas Allen, and I think we probably can, Cotton gave him several manuscripts and asked him to transmit these to the London trade. So Allen testified in four different prefaces to four different sermon series. In the earliest of these, he represented himself as someone who knew Cotton's preaching extremely well, having lived in the town next adjoining to Boston, and so had thereby the happy privilege of enjoying the benefits of the precious labors of Mr. Cotton's in his lecture upon every fifth day of the week. In other words, provenance now is proximity. Authority stems from proximity. But Allen also had stronger claims to make, insisting, for example, that he had received the manuscript of the posthumously published Certain Queries personally from Cotton, who had revised an earlier version, and he, Allen, had the revised version and was now carrying it into publication. And he insisted, too, that the copy text of another posthumous book had been corrected in some places by the author's own hand before his death, although in this particular instance, he doesn't specifically say that he had received the manuscript from Cotton. Yet to read these prefaces again and read them thoroughly is to realize that Allen spoke with a mixture of authority and uncertainty, a curious mixture of giving us lots of information and then taking back that information in some ways, being anxious about the text. I, being earnestly desired by the Christian brother, the publisher of this exposition, who, having the pen of a ready writer, did take these notes from the mouth of the preacher to give my testimony to the world that these were indeed the very sermons of that holy man. These are not John Cotton's authorial manuscript. These are the notes that someone has taken, and all Alan is saying is that they do sound like they might be John Cotton's sermons. And then he goes on to say, and this is a catchword, keyword, these are for the substance of them, parenthesis, giving allowance for such defects of the amanuensis, which cannot be but expected ordinarily, and yet I think are but very few for this treatise. Equivocal language, if ever there were one. And then on the title page of the 13th chapter book, the book on, we get pure bookseller's language. Title page, taken from his mouth in short writing, and some part of it corrected by himself soon after the preaching thereof, and all of it viewed over by a friend to him and to the truth, whereby some mistakes were amended, but nothing of the sense altered. Don't believe a word of it. Let me conclude. My understanding of John Cotton is this. There are two sides of John Cotton, or we might say a tension or an opposition that emerge from these histories of text making. There is the John Cotton who exploited the possibilities for scribal publication, a key example being, again to mention the letter that he wrote to Samuel Skelton, and yet he discovered that he himself was exploited by manuscripts that escape from his control. To engage in a small play on words, if he licensed the copying of his text to Skelton, and he most certainly did, the license of the scribal system worked against him in certain respects. It was the unbounded license of the scribal system worked against him. Secondly, as the very story I quoted at the beginning from Winthrop's journal suggests, he had a strong sense of himself as an author, as a writer, and a strong sense of the difference between a text he had prepared for distribution, or a text he had authorized, perhaps by correcting it, a text he wanted readers to have, to encounter, and yet he learned from experience and from many examples of his contemporaries that texts of his were circulating and would circulate in imperfect copies, incomplete, inaccurate, misattributed. Thirdly, he is the social author par excellence. Think of all the people who intervened to work with him. Work with him not necessarily as friends, but as foes. Roger Williams, who loved to expose what he wrote. The Presbyterian, Robert Bailey, who finally printed the letter, Salem letter, to expose Cotton for having changed his mind from 1630 to 1636. All the people who signed these prefaces. Thomas Allen, John Humphrey, William Aspinwall, and many others I don't have time to mention here, not to mention even all the personnel of the book trades who are involved in the making of his texts. So Cotton is both the writer who wants to control his work with a strong sense of authorship, and yet the writer who quintessentially was a social author in the sense that his printed works and even his manuscripts involve so many actions by others. And then finally, I think of Cotton as someone who tried, and this would be true also of Thomas Hooker and to a lesser extent of Thomas Shepard, especially true of Thomas Hooker, who rewrote a whole sermon series trying to gain control of a sermon series, unsuccessfully, I might add. Think of Cotton's practices, self-censoring, repudiating a text. I repudiate the way. That doesn't say what I really meant it to say. He says this in The Keys and later on in The Way Cleared. Correcting a text. If we can believe Thomas Allen, he's sitting there in his Boston study correcting a text. Or, as I show you in this facsimile, correcting a text. Nothing follows from that, but correcting a text. A man who's trying to correct a text, to leave behind a corrected text. A man who is trying to find someone he can trust as a collaborator or an intermediary, knowing that he's also fallen into the hands, his texts have fallen into the hands of others who have not. Such a complicated case. There is the licit cotton, the illicit cotton, the censoring cotton, the censored cotton, a cotton of many sides, and alas, we have to take him whole. Thank you very much. I can't leave the microphone because of the podcast system here. Technology, but I'd be delighted to. Yes, sir.
Were there no other books published at that time, except for these religiously oriented ones? No political tracts, no essays on society, nothing else except these religious?
How should I answer that? The answer is that... there are many other things published. Almanacs would be one example of a secular text. Histories, descriptions of exploration and discovery, reports of, you know, what people found in New England that are not religiously centered. I could go on and on. There's a lot of different kinds of texts, right? The reason that you've heard so much about religion is that Cotton was a minister, of course, and so most of what he, not everything of what he wrote, but most of what he wrote is indeed about our sermons or sermon-like texts. But there are many other kinds of texts, yes. And I'm tempted to interpolate a story of one of those texts, but I think I better not here. I guess I'll get out of. But Edward Johnson's, I will interpolate. Edward Johnson's History of New England has a fascinating textual history. Some of you know it's called The Wonderworking Providence of Zion's Savior. When it was published in 1654, it didn't have that title, and it was attributed to another author. And it wasn't until actually the 1730s. That the antiquarian Thomas Prince realized it was by that within this book with a different author's name was actually Johnson's text, and it wasn't until the 19th century that it was actually printed in the form that Johnson wanted it printed. So the secular writers are also caught up in many of these same practices. In this case, it's a bookseller's fabrication. It's not a copyist area or an intermediary. It's the bookseller who makes a book. In fact, he published it two different versions under two different titles because he was also dealing with unsold sheets, and neither of which Johnson has identified. Peter, and then I'll turn to you in the back there. Yes.
I wondered one of the papers. It's fascinating. The question I have is about the specificity of social authorship, mm-hmm. the period you're talking about, mm-hmm. and what might be different about it from anything that's previous. The thing that struck me listening to this was how central note-taking. In other words, that this changes the very notion of who controls writing. If you give a sermon, sermons are precisely the privileged site for this, because if you have note takers there, you then can't actually control what's going to happen. And it just struck me that there might be three things that really change the nature of social authorship around note taking.
Mm-hmm.
The first two are just sort of mundane things, is that graphite pencils. The first use of graphite pencils that we have at the end of the 16th century, but they're beginning to be used. And they're certainly used widely in Parliament in England. So graphite pencils make note-taking simpler. They actually facilitate it. Fountain pens, the first use of a fountain pen I discovered in England was by Samuel Pepys, taking notes from sermons. He specifies that he's trying to find better ways to speed up taking notes at sermons. And then the third thing is shorthand. And that shorthand again actually emerges as an efficient system at the end of the 16th century, but really is perfected only during the 17th century. So you have these three technologies overlapping, which enable the claim to be made for the first time, I think, that the note-taking being an exact copy of the words that were spoken. And by the end of the 17th century, there's plenty of evidence that that is actually truly feasible, that you've got exact copies of what was said. And that does strike me as a remarkable shift in the history of social authorship, to have a claim that is hard then for the speaker to disown. But the one question I have about that is about the the importance of unauthorized publication for authors. And it seems to me the significance of unauthorized publication for authors is deniability. In other words, that Franklin says the greatest mistake that Whitfield ever made was to publish. It's remarkable because Franklin is so huge, Franklin sort of made so much money out of it, and he said it was a catastrophe. In the long term, it was authorized publication, and Whitfield said incautious things which he could not deny. And he says that ruined him. That's what ruined Whitfield. And he gives a counterexample of all of these traditions where people don't publish and therefore can actually keep denying anything.
Right, right. Terrific point. And thank you for the first, since my examples were all from before the mention of the pen and the, but in any case, but thank you for that point. It's certainly true that note-taking does improve. The second point to make here, and is Michael Warner here? I can't stop. We were chatting on Tuesday about the fact that no New England minister entered the pulpit with a fully written out text. So you have the ministers preaching from notes and then having to go back to their studies and writing out the full text of what they wrote if this sermon were demanded for publication. So you have layer upon layer here of revision and addition and so forth and so on. The what's also interesting, of course, as you would know, as Peter Sellers would know very, very well, is the magnet-like, it's like a magnetism. If someone criticizes you, you have to respond. And poor Cotton is like, you know, he's stuck to this. So Robert Bailey criticizes him. He has to respond. Robert Bailey responds with another response. You know, this endless cycle of people quoting each other, responding. So there's not only the process of repudiation, and that Cotton is involved in that, but there's also the very act of being censored seems to generate more texts, which only then are in some curious way still more revealing. There's one thing I would say here for any of you who are truly interested in the 17th century, and I hope some of you won't go away from this feeling, the 17th century, but the but rather, wow, the 17th century. And that is that it's worth pondering this man, John Cotton, who was so aware of the politics of his texts, and who at the end of the Antinomian Controversy said to his colleagues, "I'm very, very sorry I criticize you. I'm going to take it back. I'm going to agree to what you said is okay." And it's not until 1659, 7 years after his death, that the full text of his sermons of the 1650s, 30s is published. The texts that are his hottest antinomian texts come out after his death. And you say, could this have been accidental? Could this have been an accident? Or is this something that he said to Thomas Allen, wait a little while, just wait a little while, and then bring these out? So there's layer upon layer here of the holding back, the denying, the reconstructing your own identity, the letting your full self out in some manner. It's just a fascinating set of layers here to Cotton's. And for some, we can't solve this. You can only surmise that certain things like this happen. In the back, yes, sir.
I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about the significance and the impact of the riots of the 1640s on sort of English, London, radical, revolutionary politics. I mean, were these texts that were read and commented on, repudiated, responded to, and I guess the second part of my question is that how Cotton, I mean, does Cotton imagine himself engaging in that discourse, in that, you know, the radical discourse of the revolutionary?
It's a very, very good question, and hard to give a short answer to it. If you look into Leveller writings, you don't find them. I think I've read a fair number of them. You don't find them citing New England godly rule texts, although Aspinwall as a fifth monarchist is a kind of a late fifth monarch. I mean, it's late in time for the fifth monarchist, 1655. There's certainly an awareness of mutualities here. The dominant impression, however, among the radicals in England is that the colonists have suppressed or censured or marginalized some version of that radicalism, which they had done quite effectively by the end of the 1640s. So you have a complicated field of textual interchange and influence and so forth. There's a huge influence on the making of Congregationalism in England, a huge influence in the early 1640s, because the tiny group of English congregationalists are heartened and learn from, even as they're also critical of, those texts. So if you think of that as radicalism, the answer would be emphatically yes. Cotton is the body mecum for those people. If you take political radicalism, I think it's a harder case to make for various reasons I don't have time to go into here. As I say, largely because Williams was pumping out critiques of the colonists for not being radical enough. That's part of the, that would be part of the answer. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I have a modern example.
Great.
A little stretch.
No.
And maybe Professor Stalybrox can correct me because the example is from England. From what I understand, in England and perhaps on the continent, there is a tradition which is not really very strong here in politics. The major parties have, of course, their politicians, their parliamentarians, but they also have a group of learned folks from all walks of life who are closely associated with the party. And I'd like to drop a name by mentioning a specific name, that of the great scholar Mo Finley. And my father once told me that his practice goes this far. When these learned folks who are attached to the party, all of the big newspapers in England understand that when these folks write to the paper, they are to be published because it is assumed that they are speaking for the party in a case in which the party itself cannot boldly come out and say that it is interested in this problem or favors this routine. And so when Mo Finley wrote to the papers about events political, even though he was a classical scholar, he would be published. And it seems to me that three things would go on here. You would get the reader, the intelligent reader who does not know Finley and who does not know about his labor connections. And he said, mine is this guy, this is wonderfully well written, this is a great idea, I'm going to call my parliamentarian. And then you get the knowledgeable reader who says, ah, Finley is writing about this, he's a big cheese in the Labor Party, the Labor Party must have an interest in this idea, and let's think about this further. But there's another possibility. There's a possibility that Finley wants to goad the Labour Party into being more closely associated in whatever routine he's talking about. So he gets up and writes a letter because he knows that all the intelligent folks knows that he's connected with the Labour Party. He writes about this thing. The party must be interested. He could be goading the party into a closer association with this party. And you have to be a very well-informed reader to know which of those three things are.
Well, certainly, if Peter wants to intervene here. Moses Finley, didn't he teach at Columbia? Wasn't he at Columbia University for a long time? Is it the same Moses Finley that we're thinking of or not? Or is he at Cambridge? Or I forgot. It doesn't matter. Let me transpose your point. Your point is that there's a politics to writing, and then the task of the historian is to uncover the specific politics and the rhetorical strategies that accompany and the publishing strategies that are part of that politics. Obviously there's change over time. I mean, there are no parties in the strict sense in the 17th century. I mean, there are coteries and communities of readers, and we can use those words in very strong or soft senses. So the particular sociologies shift over time. But your point is a richly made one in the sense that and the politics is never simple. It's never so simple. You always have to be, you can never really exhaust, I think, the politics of these texts, either in the 17th century or perhaps even closer to our own time, such as the letters that you're referring to. There's a, in the, yes, Joanne.
I guess my question is about writing with the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly that's such a wonderful dimension in the enterprise agency, because you're running and not being dragged.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of real seeking behavior, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And the wolves, or perhaps those who are trying to catch the wolves, are Shepherd and Robert Bailey and Roger Williams and John Cotton is running with the wolves. And I'm wondering, I guess, what that image, how exactly that helps us to understand the risks and benefits of anonymous publication in colonial America. Because you started out by saying there are actually a few political reasons for anonymous publication in America, because people would either know who was writing it and Yet that image of Cotton running with wolves seems to complicate that statement, right? So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about the image of the story.
Yeah, well, you know, you write and things come to your head, and so you say, well, this. But you carry it a step further, Joanne, and I appreciate that. The my point was that, which you discern, which is that, and we could call Thomas Shepard the wolf because he was actually trying to eat up, you know, eat up John Cotton, like Little Red Riding Hood. But the point was that Cotton knew he was radical, and wasn't self-centering for a while, is really out there, and then we see this change in him. It's a very literal change in him, and my point is that that just lent a terrific excitement to those early texts, and I think that's why in 1659 we finally get the most radical of his texts. Someone has had these around, or why even in 1713 someone is publishing the Salem Sermon, which he first broaches his critique of his colleagues in the ministry. I mean, it's fascinating that these things come out so late, just as it's fascinating that the short story was reprinted in England in 1692 when there's a so-called neo-nomian controversy and a New England minister by descent is sounding again the motifs of John Cotton in 1630, and somebody says, well, let's republish the short story, just squelch this thing. The last time it was reprinted until it was reprinted in the 19th century. So the point about anonymity is that it is really a flexible convention, and it doesn't have to go with being radical. Conservatives can use it too, of course. So, and the other point to make is that Cotton's name began to have market meaning in the English book trades market. So the booksellers want to put his name on text, even if they have no clear provenance at all, like the manuscript that was found behind a wall in rubbish. Who knows whether this is by John Cotton or not, but his name had a kind of marketability. So there's the field of possibilities is too large here, but being radical and running with the bulls does not necessarily. For example, Roger Williams never left his name off his books, even though Parliament orders his first book burned. He doesn't leave his name off the book. William Pynchon is the best example for New England, a magistrate who publishes in London a book, a theologically suspect book, but he puts his name on the title page, and then it's burnt in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's burned, and he's called upon to apologize. So those are examples which suggest that anonymity and radicalism are not necessarily always and everywhere conjoined, but how to explain that in terms of Cotton specifically, it's hard to do. But I just want to open up the connections there that might seem so plausible between running with the wolves and anonymity, because as I say, Samuel Gorton, the same thing, puts his name on the title page. Williams puts his name on the title page. Pynchon puts his name on the title page. They know they're going to get slammed, but they still put their names on the title page. Bob.
I just have a quick question that I thought of in passing when we were talking about the kind of contingency. In this case, kind of material contingency ascribed on the print. And it also raises the question of where social authorship connects with social readership. And it has to do with the range of marginality. You know, I just went to the exhibit at BBL on Adams Library and all the digitalization they've been doing. And, you know, you look at the discourse on Davila or on the Wollstonecraft's History of the French Revolution, that he wrote 10,000 words. There are pages that are crowded in a circle around the text. And you read Adams more than you read Wollstonecraft, right? So it raises a question, especially in those instances. And there are other instances in the literature I'm watching where there's such a tension that's produced, just another level of social authorship in all of this. So it would be as if, you know, a fifth monarchy person actually was commenting
right.
in the same way that right. some of these texts have to do with striking out, abridging all of the other things that are out there that fit into this whole element.
Right. It's a great illustration. The John Adams is commenting, and there's, as you know, a wonderful old book by Zoltan Harasti on that very process of Adams' commentaries on texts. So marginalia would figure in this story in a number of ways. I can only give you a petty illustration, and that is that in the first London printing of the Cambridge platform, there were no marginalia, and then Edward Winslow reprints it with the marginalia. But these are just scripture citations, but it does give it an authority that it didn't otherwise have. That's not a very good example, but there would be another part of the paratext, we might say, of the marginalia, either handwritten or the way the printers mess them up or use them or what their functions are. And others here in this audience could say more about this. Yes. And I know we'll have to adjourn here very, very shortly because I'm keeping you from drink and food.
I'm thinking about this congregational model as an enabler of social authorship. You talk about that. I'm curious about other circles in which that model sort of becomes active. I'm thinking, for example, it's either Joshua Reynolds' Discourses on Art or Adam Smith's Lectures on Letters. Students' notes end up resulting in the text. And I'm curious about whether you've seen other circles where this is activated, and are there differences, for example, in the paratext and the treatment of the, you know, the lecturer?
Absolutely. I hate to cite something I published, but there's in the Proceedings of the American Antiquarian Society for, 2006, there's a checklist of scribal publications, and it gets into some of this, although the term social authorship doesn't appear in that. But I mentioned student textbooks, for example, and how they're passed down and different students appropriate them and actually add to them and so forth and so on, and I refer to other scholarship on this. The clearest example of that, of course, is the coterie. The literary coterie that people like Harold Love have emphasized in their studies of scribal publication of poetry, and David Shields in his book on 18th century manuscript poetry in America, colonial America, and another coterie would be the Quakers, who have a very specific coterie-specific system of publication. They actually publish 10% of all the imprints by title in England in the 1660s, although they're only 3% of the population. I should say that most of those are very brief publications, so if you did it by sheet count, it wouldn't be 10%, but by title, it's 10%. But it's a coterie publication. It's not that many, many other people are buying Quaker publications. The Quakers are buying their own publications, and many of them are given away for free. So we could, yesterday in the morning seminar, Roger and others mentioned professional circles, lawyers writing for lawyers, circulating texts within lawyers, scribal texts among lawyers, and we could, doctors doing the same thing. And Dan Traster mentioned was it the Napier notebooks you were thinking of when you were mentioned that? But anyway, it doesn't matter, of physicians' notebooks being reproduced in certain ways. So there are many, many ways in which we could take the term social authorship in terms of community and see what happens to text, students, professional circles, and these lectures, because here I am taking notes, and you are all turning into social authors as we speak, but I think we do need to adjourn to the reception.
Social authorship can resume in the reception. Let me remind all of you that on Monday at 5:30, you will be more than welcome to come back for the third and final in this year's series of lectures by David Hall. And let me just remind again those of you who haven't signed the guest book to please do so as you leave. Thanks much.